Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June 16th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Beyond Words, Sojourners in the Wilderness, Part 4, The Diet with No Name, presented by Fred Niedner. Disc number NIF-2005-04.
And get started here. My name is Fred Niedner. I'm from Valparaiso, Indiana. And as you probably hear by now, everyone at Holden has to identify themselves by how they serve, and I serve the village this week as the village ogre. In a variety of ways, that is true, but you can interpret it however you want. One of my ways of interpreting it is to use it as an acronym. As I explained yesterday, old guy reading Exodus. We're starting each session this week somewhere in or nearby the theme story of the summer, the one we heard last evening at the reading at Vespers, the story of Moses' encounter with the burning bush and his call there to be the deliverer of Israel. Today, the subject is food, provisions in the wilderness. And so one of the things I've also done is to, as I've explained each of the other days, to begin with alleged hilarity, because Holden is a place of hilarity. If you are around Holden long enough, you begin to learn that one must be very careful joking about food at Holden.
Salmon. Don't talk about salmon.
No, we won't talk about salmon. And there are certain other things that you don't talk about at Holden as well. But anyway, I did scour my files for a bit of food humor, and I have some very lame things, because we're going to be reading some pretty lame stuff this morning. I suppose it fits, but here's one little thing I found. It's a note from a friend who I think didn't make this up, who said, "Someone gave me a book that teaches a way to achieve inner peace. Among other things, it says the way to achieve inner peace is to finish all the things you've started." So I looked around the house to see all the things I started and hadn't finished, and before leaving the house this morning, I finished off a bottle of red wine, some Tylenol with codeine, half a cheesecake, and a box of chocolates. You have no idea how good I feel. Found some good food questions in a list of great and not so great questions, theological and otherwise, that someone shared with me. This one obviously isn't about food, but it's a wonderful question. If you ever get into a theological debate with an agnostic or an atheist, you can just ask them, if there is no God, who pops up the next Kleenex in the box? I mean, really. Or, how do you know when it's time to tune your bagpipes? How do you tell? How much deeper would the ocean be if sponges didn't live there? And this is a really good Holden question. This is a kind of an Ur question for Holden. If it's true that we're here to serve others, what are the others here for? But now the food. Why do buffalo wings taste like chicken? And what do chickens think we taste like? And finally, what was the best thing before sliced bread? Well, the best thing before sliced bread was
manna.
In the wilderness. Well, the food and water stories of the wilderness are stories of difficulty and stories of controversy and worse. The wilderness tradition in the Hebrew Bible is predominated by the way we read it in the Pentateuch, which is a story of constant rebellion and apostasy, and as we'll see, litigation and just meanness. But there's another whole view of it that is, we'll brush up against it tomorrow, but it was also seen by some as the time of Israel's honeymoon with God, as an ideal period, the one period in which God and Israel got along great. Because of those references, there are some in the scholarly community who believe that all the stories of wrangling and difficulty between God and Israel that now dominate the stories of the Pentateuch are something that were, that's a layer of the tradition that God added in order to account for the patterns of God and Israel's reactions or relationship with each other in the land. And these stories are said by some to have been superimposed on the wilderness tradition in order to account for the beginning of Israel's difficulty. But we're not going to try to sort that out. We're going to go right into looking at how the food and water difficulties begin, and they begin immediately. As soon as they're across the Red Sea, as the story tells it, and have been saved from Pharaoh's armies, immediately there is trouble. So let's begin at Exodus 15. Exodus 15 has the celebration of having got away from the Pharaoh and his guys, the people having crossed the Red Sea on dry land, and the Pharaoh's armies destroyed. We could spend some time talking about the fact that we have a Song of Moses and then a Song of Miriam, and the theories about how the Song of Moses was stolen from Miriam, and that it's really Miriam's song, placed later into Moses' mouth. But we're on food today, not on copyright violations. Not that the latter aren't important. Moses ordered Israel to set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days into the wilderness and found no water. And they came to Marah. They could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. Marah means bitter. You might remember that in the book of Ruth, Naomi, whose name means pleasantness, asks that her name be changed to Mara because of all the things that have befallen her. Her life is more bitter than it is pleasant. This is that word. The people complained against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And they cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood, and he threw it in the water, and the water became sweet. All right, so far so good. That wasn't hard. By the way, we should remember, at least from the perspective of this narrative, what sort of water and food problems we might be up against. The narrator back in chapter 12, when describing the size of the group that has come out into the wilderness, says that they are 600,000 men, not counting the women and children, and not counting a variety of other miscellaneous folks who also accompanied them. So even by some odd modern standard of tallying people, if you have, in addition to 600,000 men, just one woman and one child per household, we're up to 1.8 million. You add another child on average, and you're up to 2.4 million people going around the wilderness together. And in a moment, they're going to come to an oasis that has 70 trees. And they're going to encamp there, and everything's going to be okay for a while. 70 trees doesn't amount to much among 1.8 or 2.4 million people. So we've got something a little bit odd going on here. We've got a view of this group. it's hard to imagine that we could really be involved here in a story of that much population. You know, I don't know, what's a city of 2 million people that we could use as our...
Chicago's between 2 and 3 million.
Is that all Chicago is? Mm-hmm. I always thought it was
Chicago, the confined
yeah.
city.
And wouldn't these have been indoor livers in Egypt? Wouldn't they have been? Would they have been people living in buildings, and now they have to make tent provisions for themselves? Is that logical thinking?
Yeah, they had lived apparently in villages, slave towns.
With lintels.
Pardon me?
With door.
Well, they're said to have had doors on which they could put the blood. There's a lot of things we don't know because of the way that the narrative superimposes details backwards. Like over and over again, I didn't really plan on stopping and dealing with all of this today, but you know, one of the things that we'll see if we pay close attention and did close reading here this morning, when we get to the business about the manna and the quail in a little bit, we're going to see that already now in this story here, Moses and Aaron save a bit of this stuff to put into the ark, and they actually put it in there. Well, of course, the Ark of the Covenant won't exist for many, many chapters. And all the way back in Abram's time, Abram is reported to have gained favor with God because he kept all the ordinances and the statutes and the laws of the Torah, which wasn't going to exist for 800 years. So the details of later periods easily work their way back anachronistically into older narratives. So we don't know exactly what the living conditions were for the people who were slaves in Egypt, whether they were simply a kind of an underclass who lived like what today we call migrant workers. The way the story works, they're there for 400 and some years. And so they surely become a people with, and that's twice the age of the United States. They surely had some kinds of traditions and so forth, and settled places to live, if indeed they were an established population that lived for 400 and some years as the slaves of the Egyptians. But it's really hard to know exactly how they lived and even in some ways who they were. But what we have here is a story of what we're told is a group of 2 million people suddenly out of water. And the first time they need water, things don't go too badly. They come to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they camped there by the water, verse 27. Then the whole congregation of the Israelites set out from Elim, came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed. The whole congregation of the Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. They said to them, if only we died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the flesh pots, and the word there is a word for huge cauldrons for boiling meat, and ate our fill of bread. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill the whole assembly with hunger. I love to tell my students when I go through this about these words for complaining and murmuring. Do some of you have Bibles that at verse 2 say murmur? Yeah, okay, that's a much better word than complain. Murmur catches the onomatopoetic nature of the Hebrew that's used here, as well as the Greek Septuagint translation. The Hebrew word is, if you say it the way you would say it, if you simply said he murmured, it would be lano. And what you're supposed to do is add several of them together, like you do with Isaac's name. He laughed. This murmuring word, you're supposed to be hearing lano, 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 lano. And the Greek translation is gogizo, 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 gogizo. Can you hear the murmuring? It's the onomatopoetic. That's what you hear in the crowd. They won't tell you exactly what they're saying, but you can hear them gogizo, gogizo. And and they start making immediately accusations. They thought their life was better back in Egypt. So already, at the beginning of the journey, they're ready to return. Their memory of what slavery was is so short. They are already more eager to go back to slavery and have food than to try for freedom, if it means going through the desert. So we have here then the story of the miraculous feeding in the wilderness, and the giving of this bread and quail who come migrating through or flocking through or something that provide meat. So these are the two basic food groups that they're missing, bread and meat, or some kind of bread. Now there's endless speculation about what exactly it was they were eating, and there are people who try to say, well, there's a natural explanation for this, that there is a sugary secretion of aphids at times on the desert floor that this could have been. But if you really stop to think about it, you know, a sugary secretion of aphids sufficient to feed 2 million people a day, and that pauses on the seventh day. I mean, thank goodness the aphids know about the Sabbath. they're kosher aphids. And quail that migrate through every day, also just pausing on the Sabbath, etc. So the point, no matter how you cut it, is that this is meant to be understood as a miraculous feeding, that God fed these people and that God fed them daily. Most of you know, I'm sure, that what the Hebrews called, or what the Hebrew word for this stuff, manna, comes from that question in verse 15. When the Israelites saw it, chapter 16, verse 15. When the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" Which in Hebrew is man, who? from which they take the word manna. So the word manna means, what's that? What is it? It's a popular etymology. There are some quirks to it, but that's the tradition, that the word manna means, what is it? A water controversy follows in chapter 17. From the wilderness of Sin, the whole congregation of Israel journeyed by stages as the Lord commanded, camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. The people quarreled with Moses. They said, give us water to drink. Moses said, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? But the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses. And now we've got something that I think is supposed to be funny. The word for complain here is a technical word in Hebrew for lodging a suit. So it's not just that they started complaining, they sued. You know, the litigious society is nothing new. You brought us out here, Moses, on false, on some kind of false premise. We sue. Now, I don't know exactly what court they thought they were going to take this to, but they're suing Moses for bringing them out there. He's got a liability problem. Why did you bring us out of Egypt? To kill us and our livestock with thirst? And by the way, it's interesting that they now mention their livestock after they said they had no meat to eat and they had to be provided these quail. If you read the story carefully back in chapter 12 and later on in the book of Numbers, when their livestock is actually listed and the heads of different animals are numbers, it's unbelievable how much livestock they are said to have had out there. Much more livestock than people. So they're out there, which makes the water problem even worse if you try to read this stuff just as it reads. You know, you've got 2 million people and several million head of livestock out there, all trying to find food and water. And I don't know what the animals are eating, whether they're eating manna, and the cattle are eating quail. It's a bit curious. But what we're supposed to see is that, A, God fed the people with a daily ration out there in the wilderness. And God provided them water. Now, this particular story in chapter 17 finds Moses being told to strike a rock and water will come from it, enough water to supply this enormous number of people. You will remember a later water story in which Moses will strike a rock and it will become the incident. And it's a story almost identical to this. You might want to flip to Numbers 20 and just take a look at it. It's one of the mysteries of this whole saga. The Israelites, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there. And Miriam is a name that has water as part of its root, Yam. And many commentators point out the fact that it's not surprising that at this point, with the death of Miriam, they should have water trouble again. The water is gone. So Miriam died and there was no water. Goes together really nicely. So they gathered together against Moses and against Aaron, and again they're going to sue and say, would that we had died when our kindred died before the Lord Why have you brought the assembly of the Lord into the wilderness for us and our livestock to die here? And the Lord says to Moses in verse 7, take the staff and assemble the congregation, you and your brother Aaron, and command the rock before their eyes to yield its water. Then you shall bring water out of the rock for them, and thus you shall provide drink for the congregation and their livestock. So Moses took the staff from before the Lord as he had commanded. Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock, and he said to them, listen, you rebels, shall we bring water for you for you out of this rock? Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his staff. Water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their livestock drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not trust me to show my holiness before the Lord of the Israelites, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them. These are the waters of Meribah, where the people of Israel quarreled with the Lord, and by which he showed his holiness. And Meribah is a word for a place of a lawsuit. So many generations, every generation who has read this story has pondered, why was Moses punished for this? In the earlier story, back in Exodus 17, he's commanded to strike the rock. How is he to know that the method has changed? The story is so similar. All he does is do what he did before. The last time we went through this, I hit the rock. Well, some rabbis and other scholars have said it's because he hit it twice. It would have been enough to hit it once. But he hit it twice. So that's grounds for punishment. Medieval rabbis wrote that it was because he said to the people, listen, you rebels, shall we bring you water out of the rock? Mm-hmm. Thus implying that it was he and Aaron who could do this for the people, as opposed to making very clear that the water was a gift of God, not him and Aaron. But still, after all that transpires, it seems a bit extreme that for this, given everything else that Moses could have been charged with, that happens in the wilderness, that it's this episode that gets him banned from seeing the land of promise. Well, the manna itself becomes odious to the Israelites. They, I suppose, especially if you have teenagers living with you, you know how food can become odious. But in chapter 11, you get one of the funny little things about the food in the wilderness. When the people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes, the Lord heard it and was angry, and the fire of the Lord burned against them and consumed their outlying parts. So the people cried out to Moses, and Moses intervenes for them, so the fire abates. The rabble among them had a strong craving. The Israelites also wept and said, if only we had meat. We remember the fish we used to eat in Egypt for nothing. The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic, and now our strength is dried up and there's nothing at all but this manna to look at. So by this time they'd had boiled manna, baked manna, manna fricassee, manna a la king, manna loaf. And had it with whatever it was. And yet, the tradition eventually in Judaism is that this stuff was the bread of the angels. And maybe it's from the honeymoon version of this story, not the rebellion version of this story, that the Jewish teachers in the time between the Hebrew scriptures and the New Testament came to think of this stuff out in the wilderness as nothing but wonderful, miraculous food, the bread of the angels. And in their times of oppression under the Hellenistic Empire and then of the Roman Empire, the Jewish rabbis and their writings taught that once again, someday, the bread of the angels would come. And that there would be a new day in which God would feed Israel as God had once fed the wilderness generation with a daily ration of bread of the angels. And this would be the sign of the Messianic Age. In the New Testament works with that thought in a number of ways. It's related in some ways to some eschatological, that is, some end time texts as we think of them today, such as Isaiah 25, the scene of the great banquet in the oracle of that prophet, at which God will set a feast for all peoples, a feast of wine on the lees, well refined, a feast of bone marrow and fat things, and a feast of great plenty, at which God will also wipe away all tears. So this becomes an image of God's ultimate acts of saving Israel, the great feast, the great banquet. And a table God will set, like God had once set one in the wilderness. And so we get all kinds of things in the New Testament that take this idea up, and I would like to play a bit in the second half hour this morning with a couple of those things. Of course, our story in the one miracle story that's in all four Gospels is the feeding of the 5,000. And every Gospel has its way of telling that story in such a way that it is a wilderness feeding. And, they went to a lonely place, or they went to a deserted place. And the number of people is even cited, lest we forget what we're doing here. The number of people is 5,000 men, not counting the women and children, just like Exodus says about the numbers of people that were out in the wilderness back in, it's not the same number, but it's the same way of describing the number. So Jesus sets the eschatological feast for people out there. And one of the things that characterizes the new feast, of course, is that there are leftovers. Now, you notice in the old story, you couldn't have leftovers. We didn't read that part, but I presume everybody remembers that about the manna story in the wilderness. A, you couldn't keep leftovers because it'll turn rotten on you. You had to trust that every day it would be there again. It, as the book of Deuteronomy describes it, it's a period of testing. God tested Israel every day by means of this way of feeding them. Every day they had to trust that it would be there again. Sufficient to the day is the provision thereof, as it were. But this feeding of Jesus produces savable leftovers. This is a new step. We can have more than enough. This is like the feast on top of Isaiah's mountain. It's not just what we need. It's well-aged wines, wines that have been saved for a while, etc. So Jesus does this. But it's not like Jesus is unfamiliar with wilderness testing, and that's where I'd like to spend some time with you this morning. There is a bread test that Jesus will relive, just like the wilderness generation. So just turn please to Matthew 4, which is Matthew's version. Story of the temptation of Jesus that takes place in the fuller account in both Matthew and Luke. And I know many of you have been through this a million times, but let's just play around with it one more time again this morning. Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. He fasted 40 days and 40 nights and afterwards was famished. Thus far, we're pretty much in accord with Mark, so even Mark and this much of Matthew gives us, who are familiar with the Torah, lots of allusions to work with. We're out there with the wilderness generation now in a period of 40 something or the other, and we're hungry. And the tempter comes and says, if you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread. Jesus answers, it's written, one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. Well, I spent a lot of years as a kid imagining that the temptation here to Jesus was either the temptation to do something that the devil suggested, which by itself was probably inappropriate, or the temptation to do inappropriate things to rocks. Mm-hmm. Until I finally realized there's no commandment anywhere in the Torah that says, thou shalt let the rocks be rocks. Thou shalt not change any rocks into other things. This is not a violation of Torah. This is not a temptation to do a sinful thing. What is the temptation here? What's at stake? Well, obviously, if you put this whole thing in the context of the stuff I've been talking about this morning, this is a temptation to solve the world's problems by means of providing everybody with enough. If you could change stones into bread, then you could see to it that no one anywhere hungered, provided you could solve the distribution problems, or that you could change stones everywhere into bread. But I presume you could work this out so that there would be bread enough for everyone. And no one would ever have to fight again over a shortage of food. And in fact, if you could change stones to bread, you could change stones into anything you wanted. You could change them into medicine. You could change them into cars and gasoline. You could change them into VCRs. Excuse me, now we use DVD players.
Maybe we'd have to worry about a shortage of stones at some point, though.
I don't know. There's a lot of stones. The whole place is one big stone. I'm just kidding. We could solve our problem if we just had enough stuff. And nobody ever again had to fight over stuff. Food. Food and drink, supplies, things we need and want. And isn't that the great
a great human dream. Isn't it why some of us play the lottery? What if we had an endless access to stuff? Everything we need and more. Well, there's lots of ways we can critique that. One question is, how much is enough? How do you know when you have enough? Do I have enough? Well, I never think I do. I'm always trying to work at getting a little bit more of this or a little bit more of that. But there are plenty of people in the world who would say I have 30 and 40 times what I need. Nobody ever thinks they truly have enough of everything. We always think one more thing would solve our problem. But this is one of the dreams for what the Messiah would do when the Messiah came. When the Messiah comes, the Messiah will see to it that no one starves. Once again, the bread of the angels will come, said the intertestamental sources, and no one will ever starve. So, Jesus, if you are the Son of God, see to the problem of food and stuff. Well, then the devil took him to the holy city, placed him on the pinnacle of the temple, saying, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down. For it's written in Psalm 91, which is in the Bible, and if you can't believe the Bible, what can you believe? He will command the angels concerning you, and on their hands will they bear you up so that you will not dash your foot against a stone. And if you read that in context, and a few other things like Isaiah 65 and so forth, it says that if you are truly one of God's own people, not any hurtful thing can ever happen to you. So, Jesus, if you are the one, show us. Well, this is, again, not a temptation to break a rule or a law. It's not that kind of temptation. At least as far as we know, there were no zoning laws about leaping from the pinnacle of the Jerusalem temple. Like there are, for example, you know, scaling the Sears Tower and then parachuting off, as has been tried a couple of times. There's a number of ways this has been looked at. Obviously, on one level, it's it's tempting God to prove that God's promises are true. As the text itself suggests, on one level, it's putting God to the test. But there's another great human dream here. I think maybe two of them. I don't know about you, but I have, at certain points in my life, wished that just once God would provide some display that proved once and for all that my faith was well grounded. You know, so maybe it would work if somebody could leap from the Sears Tower in Chicago and land on the street below and say, ta-da! See, everybody, it works. It's true. Trust in God. See what I've done. I don't know. Would that work for you? I mean, I know what I would say. I would say, do it again. So I want to watch how this works. I can't think of a miracle that would prove to me once and for all and take away all my questions forever. But I think even more than just wanting proof. What I really want is for the Messiah to leap, not just from the pinnacle of the temple to the Kidron Valley below, 430 feet it was, from the top of the temple down there to the Kidron Valley. I would like the Messiah to leap over the valley of the shadow of cancer with me on his back, so that I don't ever have to do that one. And over the valley of the shadow of auto accidents, so that I never have to worry about my kids when they get their driver's license. What if the Messiah could fix it so that nobody died too young? Wouldn't that, along with enough stuff, put the world right? So that nobody died tragically, everyone died at 90 with their grandchildren circled around them, singing them over to the other side. Wouldn't that fix the world?
No.
It's a great human dream. But, yeah. Would we really be fixed?
The great human dream seems to be a key part of this, versus God's dream. And I look back now at that 600,000, and at times in Scripture we find six as incomplete versus seven, perhaps. Maybe this is the great, vast, incomplete horde of 600,000, the great, incomplete human question, like the tempter's questions in the wilderness. And wilderness people are always somehow questing for their human dream to be realized.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, that's the nature of the wilderness. We're in transition, and we don't know what's good for us. Yeah, that's good.
It's interesting that the tempter's questions echo the questions of the 600,000 plus.
They do, yeah. They are the questions of the litigious generation out there who will sue Moses for these things. Yes.
It seems like the human dream both ignores the consequences of human behavior. I mean, if we could leap over the valley of cancer or the valley of auto accidents, then we don't ever have to think about the environmental practices that are increasing our rates of cancer, or the fact of automobiles and greenhouse warming, et cetera, et cetera. And also that it ignores both human consequences of our own action as well as God's will. I mean, we have this assumption that humans should live to 90, but there's nothing that says that's God's will for everyone. I mean, I don't know.
Well, there is a temptation yet to go, and happens to be one that treats a good deal of what you just pointed out. One more time, the tempter presents Jesus with a very reasonable thing that a Messiah might think about. According to Matthew, the devil took Jesus to a very high mountain. In Lucas, just he took him up to a place where you could see all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor, which would be a high mountain indeed. We're really, really up. And he said, "All these I will give you if you fall down and worship me." And Jesus said, "Away with you. It's written, worship the Lord your God and serve only him." Well, what's the temptation here? Obviously, you could say devil worship is not a good idea. And there is a commandment about this. Thou shalt have no other gods before me, no worshiping anybody else but me. But Jesus does not dispute the fact, notice, that the kingdoms of the world are the tempter's to give. The question of this temptation is, who rules the world and how do they get the power and the authority to do it? All the messianic promises say that when Messiah comes, the Messiah will rule the world. The Hebrew Bible has some pretty harsh things to say about how the Messiah is going to get that power and authority and rule. The vision of much of the Hebrew Bible is that that explains how this will happen is that the Messiah will stomp on the enemies of God's people and vindicate God's people at the expense of all those enemy peoples who have oppressed God's people before. And that is a great human dream, that God will vindicate us, stomp on our enemies, and we will be saved once and for all. Now, how should a Messiah get to the point of being able to rule the whole world? That is the question here. And this tempter in this is simply saying, bow to me, do it my way. My way is the only way that works. The ancient Christians, whose story this is, did believe that the world was in the control of the great Satan. They say so in so many words in the book of Revelation. The kingdoms of this world have been handed over to the authority for the time being of the great Satan, the great whore Babylon, which in their day, of course, we know that's code for Rome. Rome ruled the world by means, and they had their own version of peace, the Pax Romana. And how did the Pax Romana work? The Pax Romana worked like every other empire's power has ever worked. It was established by means of fear, not to mention for the sake of gain. You do what we want, or we squish you. You obey, or we nuke you. By that point of view, who is the great Satan today? Who rules the world by means of fear, not to mention for the sake of gain? Is it Guatemala? Is it Chad? Well, it's not just us.
Pretty close.
It's anybody who rules the world by means of fear and force. But wouldn't it be nice if we had one ruler, no matter how they could get power, if we could have one ruler that ruled us peacefully? Maybe we should be watching the latest Star Wars movie at this point. this is another great human dream that we unite ourselves under one peaceful ruler, and it was a messianic dream of the day, and it was a reason why many people couldn't accept Jesus as Messiah, because you can't have been the Messiah if the Romans are still in charge. It just can't be. The promises have not been fulfilled if the Romans are still in charge, and if the people are still starving. And and we live every day with tragedy. Can't be. That's not the messianic age. But Jesus, even though he will feed in the wilderness, and he will raise Jairus' daughter from death, and even though he will do a little water walking, he won't fulfill these dreams, but will instead go the way of the cross. That's how he gets authority. His only authority is the authority we find when he's made a joke of at the end of the story. And it says, where he dies, this is the King of the Jews. Now, what exactly did that accomplish? One more thing. Yesterday I ended with the Our Father, the prayer Jesus taught. I'll do the same today. The bread petition, if you flip, if you're still in Matthew, flip to Matthew 6, and Jesus teaches the people to pray in Matthew 6. Verse 11, one of the prayers is, give us this day our daily bread, we say in English. If you have a Bible with footnotes, you may have a note that says that what the Greek actually says is, give us today our bread for tomorrow. There's a wilderness prayer for you. How about, oh God, that you give us today not just this manna, this daily ration, give us already today tomorrow's bread. It's the prayer for the messianic age. It's the, and just like all the others, it's put in this once and for all language. Once and for all, God, do it. Once and for all, give us tomorrow's bread. Bring on the messianic age. What does it mean to pray for the messianic banquet? Well, I think among the early Christians, it was a prayer for the return of Christ, for the end, the consummation, however they thought of it. But I think just like that other prayer we talked about yesterday, this one too is a prayer for the meantime. It's a prayer that God would, among us, make our meal a meal that's characterized by all the things that characterize the end time meal. It's the meal at which all are welcome. It's the meal at which there is enough for everyone. And it's the meal, well, actually it's the meal you have to die in order to spread. I heard the bell, but by my watch we have a minute. Yeah.
I think too often our prayer for tomorrow's bread is more of a replication of the hoarding of manna.
Of the what?
The hoarding of manna.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean the world's version of tomorrow's bread is credit cards. I can indeed spend tomorrow's paycheck today. I can have tomorrow's bread today.
And I've thought about these, the temptations loosely in the way of, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. It's like one of the temptations is for possessions or kingdoms, the kingdom. One is for glory, the prestige, and one is for power over all, and that's like these temptations are nations' temptations. They are, which are our personal temptations. And all of them truly are God's. They are, you know, these temptations, we are tempting to be like God in power, in possession, in glory.
Yeah, the real temptation of that third one actually is let us take over.
Let us take over.
Let our people be the people that rule, because we know how to do it right. Yeah. When we take over, certain kinds will be on the first truck out. But we will run things justly.
We know what democracy is. Yeah. We know what freedom is. Right. That's what.
Right.
The temptation is.
The temptation.
We know equality. We know justice. Yeah, so let us do it. Our politics are better than your politics.
Mm-hmm. And those are our personal temptations as well, at least mine. Somehow to power, somehow to glory, prestige, somehow to things, you know?
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Well, we are out of time. If anybody wants to stick around, you're more than welcome to do that. Otherwise, coffee break is served.